Cultivate Simple, Episode 5. The Dark Side.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand.
Welcome to Cultivate Simple, an honest and unrehearsed discussion about trying to live a more simple life. And this is episode 5, and I am one of your hosts, Brian, and sitting over here beside me is your other host, and her name happens to be?
Susie.
Yes,
and everybody knows. You're not Brian, you're Mr. Chiutz.
Oh, that's right, a.k.a. Mr. Chiutz. And
can't let anyone know who you really are.
For one of our listeners out there. Hi. You know who you are. So this week, we're going to start off a little bit differently. We're going to start off, instead of with our main topic, we're going to start off talking about Around the Run. And so we still need a jingle for that. And speaking of jingles, I wanted to say that the little section of the song that you heard in the intro is a song by our friends. The name of their group, it's a husband and wife team, and the name of their group is Ellery. And you can go to ellerymusic.com, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I'm also going to put a link to the iTunes page that has that song. And we're going to play the entire song at the end of the podcast, so that's a little bit of a teaser to get at least one or two people to listen to the entire episode.
And they're fantastic. We have a lot of very talented friends, which is kind of neat. We have a very eclectic mix of people that we have met throughout our lives. And, you know, your paths cross sometimes a lot more, sometimes not so much. And Justin and Tasha, we've been friends with them for a really long time.
And just to, you know, speaking of the jingles and songs, Justin's actually going to be putting together sort of an intro song for us, so we're pretty excited about that. We're bartering some website work, since I do website development. We're bartering a little bit of that to get an actual
custom song,
custom intro song for the podcast. Yeah.
Maybe we can use it for our TV show too.
Yes, that's pretty exciting and nice little teaser there too. And that's all we're going to say about it. So this week, we're starting off a little bit differently. We're going to start off with Around the Run. And if any of you have any musical talent and would like to come up with little jingles for all of our different segments, we'll definitely use them in the show. So this week, just to let you know, because a lot of people have been asking, we are okay. The hurricane did not affect us, even though it did head for our direction. It really hit about 4 hours south of us, would be New York. And so we were largely unaffected by it. Besides one bad night of sleep, we have a couple windows in our bedroom, and that side of the house was really just getting pelted with the wind and the rain. And so we didn't sleep well that night. But other than that, and we lost power the next night when there was nothing going on, no right. wind, no rain,
for
perfectly still
hour.
Outside, and the lights went out. But since our house was built by Back to the Landers, we have two propane lights, and so we got to test those out, and they worked. So, largely unaffected. We haven't walked some of the woodlot yet, so we don't know if we have any more downed trees that we don't know about, but nothing in the immediate vicinity or in the cleared area was affected. So we're very thankful for that, and very thankful that, you know, nothing major happened. So, but this week we came back from Ohio, as we mentioned on the show last week, and we brought our mower along with us. And so that's what's been going on this week, is mowing and mulching and mowing and mulching and getting ready for winter.
And we talked about that in episode 1 or 2.
Or 3 or 4. There, we hit them all. It's in one of them. Go listen to all of them.
I think it was in one of the first ones.
Yeah.
Where we talked about mulching for winter, like winter is coming. And so we like to produce a lot of our own mulch here as much as we possibly can, because then you just know what's in it. I mean, even if you pick up leaves on the side of the road like we used to, you don't know if the people whose lawn it came from sprayed chemicals or sprayed their trees for the tent worms or any of that kind of stuff. So it's nice when you can produce as much of what you need in your garden yourself, and it saves money and time. So we've been making mulch like crazy, and it's going to mulch all of the gardens, and we'll probably save it up. We'll put some in the chicken run, and then we'll just kind of pile all the extra in a pile to be used next spring and next summer for mulching after we plant things. So,
and I would just like to say that self-propelled mowers are very nice. I think
you talked about that.
I think I mentioned it, but I don't think I explained why I said that, because our cable broke about three mowings ago on our propulsion. So, oh, maybe I did talk about it, because I remember saying something about replacing the transmission, but I still haven't fixed it. I'm still just pushing. But I have been researching tractors this week. I think we're going to need a tractor here for some of the different things that we're doing. And so, I don't know, might get a mower for that. I don't know. Expensive though, super expensive. Tractors are as much as cars. It's just, it's really unbelievable. But Tiffany, you'd included a note.
Right. And I wrote there was an article on my, a post on my blog this week about mulching and about the mulch we've been doing. And I asked people, the question was, what kind of mulch do you use? And I mean, if you haven't read it yet, go through and read the comments, because there are some great tips of what various things you can use for mulch in the garden, you know, depending on what area of the country you live in and the native things you can find in your area. And Tiffany from 20 by 20, that's her blog. She says that she uses sweet gum balls from her tree to mulch around plants that she has trouble with the animals bothering. And that's a great tip, I think. We don't have a sweet gum tree as far as I know. I don't know. We could walk around. But I mean, that's a great tip, because they're those little like spiny balls. And then you could put those around, I don't know, maybe your broccoli if you have trouble with the groundhogs and stuff eating your broccoli. But that's a great tip to try in your garden if you have access to those. I know my mom's neighbor has a big tree, and they are always complaining about all the little sweet gum balls that drop. So, I mean, it might be an interesting thing to try out if you can find access to it.
And that's definitely something, too, that I was listening to one podcast. I can't remember which one it was, but the guest was a sorghum farmer from either Kentucky or Tennessee, and he was talking about mulching with different herbs and different plants around other herbs and plants, like garden plants, that would deter pests. So that's definitely something we can explore in a future episode. Mm-hmm. Natural pest control. That's a whole discipline in itself, but that's definitely something we could talk about in the future. So an update on the ducks. As we mentioned, we have ducks, and they've been a ton of fun.
They're about a month old now, because they were born, or they hatched, I guess, October 6th. So
yeah, our neighbor Matt, he has chickens and has been giving us a lot of advice, and just has very good general knowledge about a lot of things, you know, around the farm. And his comment when we said we had ducks was that you guys really like to get things out of season, don't you? So we've been bringing the ducks in every night. They're staying in the office during the night with the little heat lamp on them, and then we put them out during the day to...
Right, and they could be outside. We just don't have an electric fence set up yet, or any kind of a housing that we can put them in to keep them safe from predators. And since they're so small yet, you know, they don't have the mother duck around to protect them, you know, we need to keep them safe. Otherwise, we might lose them all to predators. So they'd be all right outside. And ducks do. I was reading about that actually earlier this week, and they were saying that ducks, wild ducks, often do reproduce and hatch out their clutches way earlier than chickens do, just because they're a little more weather hardy than chickens. So
maybe
they're not out of season. I'm pretty sure mama ducks know what they're doing.
Yeah. So we're getting the electric fence
Monday,
tomorrow. Or when this podcast comes out. So maybe we could put Lucy out there as the mother duck.
Oh, yeah.
She wouldn't want to stay outside, though.
Probably not.
I mean, it gets down to, you know, 62 degrees in the house at night, and we have to cover her up, or she shivers and complains. So she's not a very hardy chiote, that's for sure.
Such a great farm dog.
Yeah. And that's another thing that we've been talking about, too, is we've been kind of discussing animals on the farm and around the run here, and how it's very important to have animals that serve a purpose. So that's another thing we've been talking about, is the next dog we want to get, because Lucy is coming up in, we were just saying this, in March, she'll be 11 years old.
In February, she'll be 11.
And she is getting old. She's starting to get a lot of gray around her muzzle and her eyelashes, and just, you know, harder getting around. We've been taking her on more walks, but we've been talking about dogs and...
Right, getting dogs for protection and predator control, or, I mean, there are other methods too. Donkeys, llamas, that kind of thing. But,
yeah.
So we're exploring our options to see what might be best for us.
Right. And another huge thing that happened this week, and I don't think we mentioned it on the show last week because it didn't finalize, and it's actually not completely finalized, but it will be soon, hopefully, is that we sold our house.
Yay!
We've been trying to sell our house back in Ohio, of course, ever since we moved to Maine, and we are under contract, and according to our realtor, it's a very... capable couple. How do you say that?
Know.
Like a loan worthy. They shouldn't have any.
Responsible, I guess.
They shouldn't have any trouble getting you know a mortgage, and they're selling a house. The funny thing is, they're moving from about a half mile away,
and they have a house on the lake, which
typically it's
the
other way
desirable.
Around.
Most people go from a house like ours and then end up buying a house on the lake.
Yeah, so they're going.
But they're
the
doing
wrong
the
way.
Opposite, and they're doing it, I believe she said, for privacy reasons, because there's just, when you're on the lake, obviously, you know, you've got boats and jet skis and stuff going by all the time, and it's like people are in your front yard all the time. So,
and in your backyard, because you have the road on the
right,
other side.
So, and our house is very private, because we have both the lots on the other side and woods behind us. So it's, you know, it's pretty. They'll like it, I think, for that reason.
Right. So that's pretty exciting. The thing that leads to, though, because as we talked about in our debt show, we had paid off our mortgage a couple years ago. And so now that opens up a lot of doors when you sell your house and you have it paid off, because you get a big check. And Susie and I have this idea that they should really...
And I really wish the check was like the
like
size
the
of the...
publisher's clearinghouse.
The size of the check was like directly related to the amount that it was for. So, you know, when you get a check for $5, it would be really small. But, you know, if you sell your house and get a check for $150,000, it's this ginormous check that you can take into the bank. I think that would be really great.
And if Ed McMahon handed it to you, it'd be even better.
That's right. With some balloons
probably
and some
not
confetti.
Happen. Yeah. So that leads, though, to interesting questions about what to do with that huge check that you get once you deposit in the bank. We want to, obviously, because we hate debt, we want to send in a huge chunk on our mortgage that we have on our current place, since we went back into debt to get this place. And so we want to pay that off as quickly as possible. But in the same way, there's a lot of things around here that we can do. And this kind of ties into our debt show. Or a lot of things that we need to do, but obviously, you know, I mentioned the tractor. We've talked about a log splitter, because we're going to heat with wood here, and I don't have a log splitter, so we need to get that. There's some other things that we'd like to do to the house, just to update it a little bit, but, you know, you start to debate, are those things necessary, or...
Or can we put them off for a couple of years?
Right, can we put it off? Yeah. Or should we put it off until we pay off the house, which, you know... We're hoping isn't going to be but a couple years, but, you know,
right.
Depending on what happens, you know, you never know. So we're debating about that right now, and discussing it and planning it out and making a list of things we want to buy and how much they cost, and, you know, trying to keep that huge chunk to send into the mortgage, but in the same way, you know, making plans for what would make our life easier. And also things that we want to do, you know, trees that we want to plant, or bushes, blueberry bushes, different things like that that take several years to get going. So it's good to plant those now. So what do we want to do immediately, and what do we want to do, you know, in a couple years? So that's been going on around the run this week. And also, it's one of those things that Susie's been doing, what, now for 3 years now? You've been doing your calendars?
Yeah, this will be the fourth one that I'm working on right now, the Chiyotsuren calendar. Yeah, I've been going through my pictures this week and picking out which ones I think will, you know, look best in the calendar. I always try to pick out. It's hard to narrow it down. I always try to make the pictures correspond with the month that it's in, because nothing is more annoying to me when you buy a calendar and it's, you know, there's a picture of snow in July or something weird like that. So I've been going through and trying to pick out the best pictures, and it's always hard to do, I think, to narrow it down and to try to figure out what you want to feature and what you want to put in there, and trying to decide if, do I want a picture of the chickens in there, or do I want to just do a more of a landscape picture? But yeah, I've been going through and that's almost done. So that should be up on the blog probably later this week. I need to get them ordered because we're going to be celebrating Christmas with my family the week after Thanksgiving, because we're going to go back to Ohio and we're just going to stay there and do it all at once. So that kind of shaves a month off of my timeline as far as Christmas. And because we celebrate a homemade Christmas with my family, I've got to get all of those presents done a month early, and I hadn't thought about that. So that kind of puts me under the gun. So I need to get these ready and ordered so that I get them in time. So yeah. So keep your eyes peeled for those.
A lot of people asked about buying pictures at various points and buying prints of some of your photos off the blog. And this is a good way to do that because, obviously you don't get to pick which print you want, but you have 12 to select from. And you can take those apart and, you know, frame them.
Right, which I have done, because I should get some of my pictures printed out and hang them around, but it's just one of those things that I never really get around to.
It's one of those things we're always going to do, but never.
Right. Never, right.
Yeah, get around to. So yeah, be looking for that. And that's a great way to support the blog too, because we do get them printed through a third party, through Lulu. Is that the name of that place? Mm-hmm. But we do make a couple dollars on each one. So if you'd like to support the blog and the podcast and any future endeavors and the run here, right, then, you know, buy a couple calendars. They make great gifts, and they're really, really beautiful, because Susie is a great photographer and gets many questions about that. One of which I think we'll be answering later. So, and I wanted to mention, too, the Amazon Associates link. And I also wanted to say thank you to all of you. I was pretty encouraged this week because we had a couple reviews on iTunes for the podcast, and that was great. Again, you know, if you want to support the podcast in a way that doesn't cost you anything and won't take much time, go to iTunes and just write up a little review and give us 5 stars. 5 stars. Andrew, really? 4 stars? Thanks. Anyway, calling you out live, buddy. So that leads us into the fail of the week. And the fail of the week this week goes directly into our main topic for the day, which is the dark side. So this week, when we got back from vacation, or not vacation, but from working in Ohio, we found a dead chicken in the coop, and
we knew it had been sick because we had the neighbor come up and check on everything, and she mentioned that it was. But we were in Ohio, so there wasn't much that we could do, and you know, you can't expect other people to be responsible.
Well, and not only that, but we knew. There's a couple of, there's another one of the chickens now. There were two of them that just, they don't stick with the rest of the pack. They don't.
We call them the dumb ones.
Yeah.
They can't figure out how to get back into the coop. They're just.
There's something wrong with them.
They're too inbred, I think.
Yeah. And that is why you buy heritage breeds.
I don't know.
But
yeah, I mean, they're just not as vigorous as the other ones, so. Like it's to be expected. I don't know if they're the old ones. I mean, we don't really know this flock too well since we inherited them. But yeah, it's just one of those things that happens sometimes.
Right, and then later on in the week, it was kind of the same situation. The ducks that we got, we got 8 of them originally, and one of them just was not growing at the same pace as the other ones. Just was really skinny, was always kind
really of small,
off by itself.
Yeah, it didn't forage like the rest of the ducks, so I'd put them outside in their little duck tractor, and it would, you know, eat some out of the bowl, and then it would just go sit under the heat lamp. And at first, I just thought it was going to be a female duck, because they're smaller. I mean, with Muscovies, that's kind of what I've read, how you tell the difference between the males and the females, and I just assumed they were reaching that point where I was going to start noticing the size difference, but... So at first I thought, oh, well, this one's just going to be a female, but then the other small ones started growing, and then this one just kind of stayed small. So I kind of kept my eye on it and thought, well, maybe it's just the runt and it's not getting as much food. So a couple days I fed it by itself so it would get enough food, but then, you know, it just wasn't as vigorous as the other ducklings. So I was keeping my eye on it because I thought, you know, this one probably isn't going to make it because it just wasn't thriving. And yeah, sure enough, one day we went out and checked and it wasn't doing very well. So we brought it inside, put it by the wood stove and gave it some water to see if that would, with a little apple cider vinegar in it, to see if that would revive it. And it kind of did for a little bit. It only survived for a couple hours and then it became fertilizer.
Yeah. And so that leads us into the main topic, since those were our two fails of the week, but technically they weren't our fails.
Right.
That's just kind of the way it is. I mean, right. That's the way nature is, that there are weak and there are strong.
Right.
And that really reminds me of that book quote that I should look up real quick. one of my Star Wars books that I read. But so you were reading about... chickens. You're still reading.
Yeah, and the funny thing
chickens.
Is, those I'm still working through that chicken book, the small scale poultry flock, and I was reading. I happened to be reading the chapter on breeding, and he talks in there about how when you're going to breed animals, you need to be just kind of ruthless about culling the weak and the ones that aren't vigorous, because you don't want those genes to be passed on. I mean, obviously through breeding, you want to ensure the health and the vitality of the future flock. And that's why you're breeding, because you want to develop chickens that do better in your situation, that forage better, that can deal with your climate better, that can, you know, I mean, that's why you're breeding, or to preserve certain rare breeds. And the last thing you want to do if you're doing that is to breed animals that aren't up to par, I guess you would say. And I mean, That sounds kind of harsh, but you're not doing the breed any favors, and in the end, you're doing everything a big disservice if you don't do that. I mean,
and it's interesting just listening to the way that you're talking about it and how you're saying the different things, because I really think that death and, you know, culling and those types of things, we dance around them and sort of try to tread lightly on them, because it is death, you know, it's the end, it's final. And that's something that I think as humans, we don't want to face that in our own lives. And so we try to soften it. We try to get around it. I mean, like the duck that died, we were very sad about that. And it just made us, you know, it's a disappointment in one way, because you've put time and you've put energy into it. But in another way, you feel kind of helpless because you can't do anything about it. There's no way to get around it, but that's the way it is. I mean, that's the way nature is. That's the way life is. It's like in the woods. I was thinking, as you were talking about deer, you know, and the weak and the sickly deer, those are the ones that are the first to go, that get eaten by predators.
Right.
And so that's nature's way of handling it.
Right. And in one way, that's a good thing, because if there weren't weak, the predators would starve. And, you know, when you read about predators and all of that kind of stuff, and when you watch certain nature shows, they talk about that, how there's this undulation of, you know, population and predator population and, you know, the populations of the things that they eat. You know, and if there weren't weak in any species, the predators wouldn't have much to eat, so there wouldn't be predators around. And predators play an important role, because
they
help
weed out
cull
the
weak.
Pool.
I mean, that's how nature does it. They weed out the gene pool and keep the weak from reproducing, which then makes the deer and all of the animals that are, you know, preyed upon makes them healthier. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting relationship, one that we don't like to think about as humans, I don't think, because we're kind of like the top predators. So that makes us feel kind of weird, you know, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It makes us feel like we're playing God, or, I mean, I don't know. It's just one of those weird things that a lot of people don't want to discuss or think about, really. But it's something you really have to think about and come to terms with if you're going to have chickens, or if you're going to have ducks or whatever.
Or any kind of animal.
Or pets or anything, whether they be farm ones or indoor cats, you know.
We've known a lot of people that have had, and you know, depending on what type of animal you're talking about too, it comes down to a quality of life issue.
Right.
So like, say you have a dog, we'll take for instance, and that dog gets an injury of some sort, or is sick, or gets cancer, or whatever it might be. We've known people or heard stories about people that have spent, you know,
tens of thousands of dollars
to fix the animal, or to get some sort of surgery, or to make it more comfortable for a couple of months. And it's, you know, I think it goes back to that facing death. We don't want to face death as humans, because I think that shows us our own mortality, and it sort of reflects that at some point we're going to die, and we want to take every measure possible to extend our life for a couple of hours. And so we want to do that for our animals too. But I don't think, especially when you're talking about farm animals, and when you're talking about, you know, ducks and chickens and these types of things. I mean, we were watching a show this week, and you can check it out on YouTube. It's a really great show called Wartime Farm. Well, some parts of it are great. But they had a cow, one of their best milking cows, that one of its teats got stepped on and was basically cut off, and it wasn't going to heal. And so they culled it. That was it. That's the way it is on a farm, that the weak and the you don't want to pass on those genes. So let's say that duckling lived. You know, let's say
right,
we did all
already,
these heroic
right.
measures to, you know.
Right. And I had decided, because some of these ducks we are planning on keeping for breeding. And so I figured, well, I need to make sure I note this duck. And this has to be one that, because it's not vigorous and doing well, I can't breed it. It has to be one that's culled when it reaches like adult table weight, I guess you would want to say, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the way it is. And I think that you also have to think about it. And from a genetic standpoint, you know, you don't want to breed these animals, but also from a sustainable standpoint. I know a lot of people that have chickens and stuff, and they do it because they're healthier, you know, they want to have chickens, et cetera, et cetera. And they keep their chickens around. They don't, you know, some people cull their chickens at 2 years because they become less productive. Some people don't want to do that. They think that, you know, they don't believe in doing that. So they keep the chickens around, even if they're unproductive, because they've been, you know, a productive member of the family or whatever. But you also have to balance out kind of the sustainable side of it, because those mm-hmm. animals are then eating up resources, and they're also producing pollution, because if you're not mitigating it properly, all of the manure that they produce can become a pollutant and can become an issue in the waterways and stuff. So I think there's definitely a balance that you have to find. I think it's interesting when you see, we've been looking at Craigslist, and you see on there where people have a bunch of roosters that they want to get rid of because they don't want them and they don't want to keep them around. But then they say in their ad, well, these aren't for slaughtering. We want you to take these roosters and give them a home at your place. We don't want them, you know. We don't want to take responsibility for the fact that we got a bunch of chickens and half of them ended up being roosters. We don't want to slaughter them and don't think they should be killed, but we don't want to be responsible for them. We want someone else to have to take them and deal with them. And I think that's incredibly irresponsible. If you're going to get chickens or something, you have to be okay with that. You know, I don't think you can pawn your unwanted things off on other people and expect them to abide by the beliefs that you have. I mean, it's kind of the ruthless nature of the way it works. You know, often the extra males are not as valuable as the females because they can't reproduce, and you know, you only need a specific a low number of males
right
for breeding and all of that kind of stuff. So I mean, it's one of those interesting issues that comes about.
And it's interesting because we were talking to BJ, our neighbor, and she said, oh, the poor males of nature, you know, it was yeah. like, because they always get the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
But it's interesting in just thinking about bees, you know,
yeah.
we've kept bees in the past, and we're going to here in Maine, and within a beehive, the drones are actually, which are the males, are a very small part of the population. And the only thing that they're good, they are not productive members of the hive at all.
They just eat up resources.
Yeah, the only thing that they're there for is to mate with the queen, and not even really the queen from their own hive.
No, from other hives.
And so a lot of times in the winter, the worker bees, which are females, will actually kick all the drones out of the hive to freeze. And then they'll just create new ones
right,
in the spring.
Right, because they can't be having them around eating up resources all winter because they're so precious.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's the way nature does it. That's the way nature right. handles it, is culling the
right.
males. And saying this as a male, it's very difficult for me.
Right. And a lot of times, the male species, there was an interesting comment, I think it was on the blog when I talked about ducks, getting the ducks, and someone commented, oh, I saw these Muscovies because they have wild and or feral ones down in Florida. And she said, oh, I saw two males fighting really terribly, and I was just turned off towards ducks. I just don't like ducks anymore because there were two males fighting ruthlessly. And I was thinking to myself, don't males of pretty much any species do that? You know, I mean, that's the way it works. They fight for dominance, and then the strong one survives and passes on its genes. That's
right.
the way it works.
And that's
we kind of, when
I mean,
we get in there and meddle around and right. try to save them, and I mean, yeah, it's the dark side. We're not doing them any favors. We're actually being detrimental towards that. And this comes into play too with plants. I was thinking about it in relation to when you start seedlings, you know, you start 4-5 seedlings in each little tray, and you're supposed to cut down all of the ones, you leave the most vigorous one and cut down the rest. And it used to kind of bother me. I used to separate them out and, you know, try to plant all of them, but then you end up with too many plants. And when you really think about it, you want the strongest ones because those are going to be the ones that are the most disease resistant, the most pest resistant. Those are the ones, if you're going to be saving your own seed, that you want to save the genes for. That's how you're going to develop better and better species of plants for your particular garden region. You want to save the tomatoes that fruit first and that can, you know, withstand colder weather. That's how all of these different species came about, of all the different heirlooms. And that's some of the diversity that we've lost with hybridization and all of that other stuff. So, I mean, it comes to play not just in the animal world, but also in the plant world. So, yeah, it's one of those. It kind of stinks, but in the same way, it's beneficial in the long run.
And it's part of life. I mean,
right.
you know, that old saying that the only two things guaranteed in life are death and taxes, and
right.
you know, and that's true. I mean, we are all guaranteed that end, and so is every plant, and so is every animal. You know, nothing lives forever, and so us trying to extend the life of a plant or extend the life of an animal a lot of times has, like you said, detrimental, you know, consequences.
Right.
Yeah. So,
but then there are also things you can do. I think we should talk a little bit about, you know, and it's not quite that black and white. I think that, you know, we should focus on, instead of being reactive when it comes to the animals and the plants that we have around, we need to focus on being proactive. So we need to focus on developing healthy soil, which is going to give your plants the best possible option to survive. You know,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to have crappy soil and not do anything to feed it, and then plant plants in there, and then you spend all summer with overrun with pests and with not as good a fruit and underproductive plants. And so if you focus on developing good soil, you're going to reap the rewards in the plants that you have, and it's going to be better for your plants. And the same goes with animals. I think we should focus on making sure that we are doing all we can to keep them healthy so we don't have to deal with sickness and disease as much. And then it's easier when that does happen because you know you've done everything possible. So it gives you a better peace of mind. You know, I know that my chickens aren't getting sick because I'm feeding them sub-quality food, and because they're being cooped up in somewhere that's too small, or they're not getting enough fresh air, they're not getting sunshine, they're not getting exercise. I know that's not the case. You know, it helps you understand and realize that, you know, it's because it's probably a genetically weaker animal.
Yeah, individual.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I think that in doing that, it also gives you peace of mind when that does happen. Because, you know, I mean, I know that I've been giving these ducks everything they need to survive and thrive. And seven of them are thriving and one of them didn't. You know, it's not by any fault of mine. It's just because that's the way it is. And right. And I've been doing everything in my power to give them the option to thrive. So, and it's kind of like that quote of ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's really true. It's better to, and it's easier and less stressful when you just develop habits that focus on boosting health and vitality and the healthfulness of your animals rather than being reactive when things happen and when animals get sick and not knowing what's going on. And
and it's like that with us too. I mean, whether it be the things that we eat or the things that we do or the things we put into our body or the things we put our body through, it's the same thing with humans too. And when you were talking about that, it reminded me of troubleshooting. Whenever we have a technical problem, you know, the internet's not working or something, it's, you always try to figure out what are the variables, what are the things that have changed, what are the things that that aren't set up necessarily correctly, and then those are the things that you go through and fix. And it's the same thing with animals or with our own bodies. You know, a lot of people, I have a family member that deals with asthma, and right now I'm doing some research on, because, you know, his way of dealing with it is by taking drugs for it, or by, you know, using an inhaler or different things like this. And I've been doing a little bit of research recently on, you know, what are different things he could do for his diet, because he exercises like a beast. And so it's, you know, it's not that, but what are the things that he could do that are the bigger issues, I guess you could say. And so, like you were saying with, you know, providing the ducks everything that they need, you know that when something goes wrong, that you know what the problem is. It's the duck. It's not, right, you know, something else that's going on. And if your whole herd or if your whole flock gets sick, then you know that it's something bigger,
right?
You know, so it's just, it's a way of narrowing down and figuring out what's wrong so that you can fix it. It's just like our cats. We went away for a week of vacation, and we're going to do a future show. It might actually be next week. We were talking, right, about feeding your animals a raw diet, and we've been feeding Lucy and all of the cats a raw diet for several years now. And it's interesting because we went away for a week of vacation, and just to make it easy on ourselves and on BJ, who came up and checked on the cats for us while we were away, we feed them kibble, you know, and we get Wellness. It's a good brand, doesn't have a lot of grain in it, you know, it's been really good. But it's really interesting because now that, well, and not now that, you know, not that it's a result of them eating raw and then switching back to kibble, but just because of the ingredients and the processed nature of kibble, both Samson and Sophie, our two indoor cats, have got just really small scabs all over them. It's almost like Lucy with her hot spot when she got into the chicken feed. But they just, Sophie's got one right on her chin, and Samson just gets them all over. We'll be petting him, and you just feel these just like little scabs everywhere. But the only thing that's changed is that food. And so we know what's causing the problem. It's just like when Lucy got into the chicken feed. You know, the only thing that has changed for her is that she did that stupid thing. And so, you know.
And we knew through previous experience yeah. that that's what caused it. And that's what we know with our cats, too. Whenever we travel and feed them kibble, we know that Samson starts having skin issues because of, you know, the food. And we've tried all different kinds of, you know, the better kibble for him. And it's just something to do with the processed food with him. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And I think that when you do start weeding out those things, and I notice it particularly in my own kind of health too. Once, I mean, we eat really healthfully, and we, you know, we traveled back to Ohio and we were eating things we don't normally eat, more sugar than usual, more refined foods than normal. I just noticed that I wasn't 100%. You know, I would say you're a little more tired. You get tired more easily. You don't
have as much energy. Right. It's not easy to wake up in the morning.
Right. Yeah.
You can't go full steam yeah. all day long.
Right. And people often ask me, how do you guys accomplish so much throughout the day? And I'm a big believer that it's because we are fueling ourselves and trying to maintain our bodies in optimal health through what we eat and what we consume.
It's interesting too, going back to what I said about troubleshooting and taking all the variables out. Once we kind of cut down everything in our lives, then as soon as you introduce one of those variables, it's amazing the immediate reaction that you see. So we don't eat a lot of sugar. We haven't for a while. And so whenever we, you know, have some sort of sweet dessert that just has a ton of sugar in it, I mean, you can feel the physical effect of that, the rush that you get from the, you know, the literal sugar high. And I think that so many people are so inundated with, you know, processed foods and with sugars and with soda and with, you know, all these different things that they don't realize that anymore, or they don't notice the effect anymore. But yet that's putting your body under stress and strain, and that's not good for you. I mean,
it's like a constant state of aggravation almost. And so then when you are, and the same goes for the animals. I mean, this all goes in the same, and plants and everything. If you're under a constant state of stress, be it environmental or because of what you're consuming, when you do come into contact with virus, sickness, you know, when your plants come into contact with pests or whatever, you're going to succumb a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're not going to be able to fight off that cold. If you do get the cold, it's going to be worse than it would be if you were under optimum health, and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think it brings kind of the focus back around into maintaining, I don't know, just
a healthful lifestyle, not only for yourself, but also for your plants, your animals, yeah. for everything.
And it's all about being proactive. I mean,
right. So what are the things, let's get into some practical things then. So okay. What are some practical things that you can do?
The best ways to prevent disease and issues with plants, your animals, yourself, is to eat good food.
Yeah.
I mean, really, our food is like the foundation of, yeah, we all are going to have some genetic predispositions to certain diseases and certain issues and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you can't really, you know, like that duck just has a genetic, that little duckling just wasn't as strong genetically, even though it was being fed good food, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so we all have a predisposition to certain diseases, yeah. certain issues, et cetera, et cetera.
My favorite thing to sound smart in a crowd is Occam's razor, right?
Yeah.
That all things being equal, the simplest explanation is usually the right one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the truth. All the genetic stuff and everything, this is kind of like base thought. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the best thing you can do is eat good food, because you're going to give yourself that kind of foundation. I mean, you want to build a really solid foundation. So if you can, grow some of your own food, because you know that's going to be the healthiest. Mm-hmm. If you have good soil, your food is going to be healthier than food grown in other subpar soil.
Well, and as if you grow your own food, you know, the nutrients and all those things that your body needs in order to be healthy, all that stuff is in the food. And as soon as that is picked, it starts to disappear.
Right,
so
the minerals starts to deteriorate over time.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so if you're buying something that was picked in California a week ago, then a lot of the, I mean, you're getting full and your stomach feels like it is filled, but all of the nutrients and all the minerals and all those little things,
micronutrients and macronutrients, yeah. And the same goes for the soil too, because the soil gets depleted of those, and unless the farmers are being proactive about adding those back in, about
mulching,
cover crops, rotation, adding rock and mineral dust, trying to reinvigorate the soil, the food becomes less and less healthy and has fewer and fewer vitamins and minerals over time. I mean, and that's been proven in testing. So if you can grow it yourself, all the better. If not, try to buy it from a local farm where you know that it has been picked as freshly, like
that day, that
that's
morning.
Fresh. And that goes with, I mean, you know, storage crops like potatoes and stuff, or, you know, that's a different story. But yeah, as fresh as possible from local farms, obviously that's going to make it the healthiest food you can buy.
And one of the things that you started a long time ago, and how you actually got me to eat more and more vegetables, is that because I didn't eat a ton of vegetables growing up. I mean, typical stuff that, you know, Midwestern corn, green beans, you know, that type of stuff. But one of the ways that Susie actually got me to eat vegetables was she would sneak them in places. So she would take spinach and cut it up so fine that it looked like, you know, an herb, and put it in pasta sauce and, you know, spaghetti sauce. And so I'm eating, and it's amazing when you take, you know, a pound of spinach and you cut it up and cook it down. It really becomes next to nothing as far as volume. And so you put that into a pasta sauce and you've got a pound of spinach that now you're feeding your family. They don't even know it. And yet they're getting, you know, a lot, probably mm-hmm. not all, because you're cooking it a little bit and so on, but they're getting a lot of the nutrients out of that. And so using, you know, vegetables in that way, and also, you know, spices and other things, right?
Right. And I would also encourage you to eat a wide variety of foods and include lots of spices and herbs in your diet. I don't think a lot of people realize that spices and herbs are actually more healthful than vegetables are. Even though you just use them in a tiny quantity in your food, they're going to add tons of vitamins, minerals, macronutrients, micronutrients, all those different kinds of things that you often can't get from plants and vegetables. But they come in the herbs and the spices. And if you can incorporate a wide variety of those into your diet, you're adding and balancing out and getting a wider variety of beneficial, you know, immunity boosting and health boosting qualities, because you're eating a wide variety of food, and especially herbs and spices. I mean, that's one of the easiest ways, I think, to add health to your diet. So if you're eating, I don't know, mashed potatoes, put some garlic in there, put some chives in there, put some, you know, some butter in there, put because butter, you know, if you're eating real butter, grass-fed butter, it's packed full of all kinds of health and immunity boosting properties. And this, you know, the spices, add some freshly ground pepper to that, and your mashed potatoes are going to be healthier than if you just mashed potatoes and added a little bit of milk to them. You know, I mean, all of those little things that you can add, you can just keep layering in more and more vitamins, minerals, and nutrition into your meals. And there, I'll add a book in the show notes that's really fantastic. That's a great read. I mean, Hippocrates, who's the father of modern medicine, was the person who said, let your food be your medicine, and your medicine be your food. And I mean, that's just genius. And if you're eating herbs and spices, it's kind of, you know, I mean, you've heard of herbal medicine. That's really, a lot of modern medicine is based in herbal medicine. And a lot of, you know, common medications are synthesized versions of herbs. So yeah. And if you struggle with specific, like a predisposition to some sort of a genetic thing, you can make sure you're including certain herbs and spices in your diet that are going to help you maybe deal with and mitigate or not have to deal with those specific genetic predispositions. Mm-hmm. You know, so if mental health issues run in your family, maybe you need to read up and consider introducing fish oil and getting some vitamin D and maybe some St. John's wort on a weekly or a daily basis. You know, and you can kind of help balance out some of maybe those genetic predispositions that you have simply by introducing certain foods in your diet. You know, I mean, there's a reason that the Northern Europeans take fermented cod liver oil. That's because it provides vitamin D, which they don't have a lot of in the winter. So, I mean, you know, people in the islands don't necessarily need that because they're getting lots of vitamin D. So,
and it's really interesting too when you think about, you know, of course, most of our society goes to the grocery store, they pick up, everything is processed, everything. And when you look at processed food, it's amazing because they strip everything out of everything.
Yeah, and often processing is essentially
breaking it down.
It's kind of like breaking it down like what your body would do, and it often oxidizes and strips out a lot of the nutrients that are in it. And then they're often in the case of like cereal or something, like, say, so they process everything down into its different parts, and then they will add, you know, the wheat bran back in with the wheat, and then they'll add in vitamins and minerals because all of those were essentially stripped out and often oxidized during the processing, the heat, you know, and all of that stuff that happens in processing. So then they add it back in, but they add back in synthesized versions of those, which a lot of times our bodies just see as, I mean, they're chemicals. So our bodies just see them as kind of a toxic chemical. So you're not getting, when you're eating a whole grain cereal, you're not getting the same benefits you would as if you would be eating like a soaked whole grain cereal where you got the whole grains, you soaked them overnight in some, you know, buttermilk or something and cooked them up in the morning like an oat groat. It's just not the same. Theoretically, the label will tell you it's the same.
Yeah, it's
but I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that it's just not the same. Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing to think about.
It's always interesting when you see those product labels that say that they're enhanced with this and that, and it's something that if it was actually that thing in its raw form would already have it in there.
Like milk, for example. Right. Milk is a great example of this. If you drink whole raw milk, it has vitamin D in it because the animals are eating grass, and you can see it in the summer. The cream is yellow, 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 whereas if you drink like a skim milk from the store, it's going to have vitamin D added to it because they skim out the cream and they're taking out a lot of the vitamins and the nutrition in the milk. And then they're heating it and processing it, which also degrades a lot of the vitamins and the nutrients in it. So then they have to add it back in. I mean,
why not just start?
And then
start
they tell
it
you it's the same.
Yeah.
But the very idea that they have to add back in the nutrients that are lost tells me that it's not the same, you know. That right there is an admittance that it's not the same, regardless of the fact that they claim that it is.
By doing these things too, you know, the topic of today is death and the dark side, as we call it, the dark side of, you know, of farming or of keeping animals and for ourselves too. It's interesting that we as a society and as the United States as a country, you know, spend billions and trillions of dollars on healthcare when a lot of these things could be taken care of preventatively. And so hopefully, you know, in us discussing this today and sort of going over it quickly, and we could spend a whole show on spices.
I could spend
and,
hours on all of this.
Yeah, because you've studied it extensively. Mm-hmm. And that's, if you do have something, it's interesting to me too. This is kind of a side note, but it's interesting that whenever somebody has something specific, they always ask you if you have something or if you have an issue, some of the things that that Susie mentioned that, you know, genetic disposition, or like I said, with asthma, just do a Google search on natural remedy whatever. So, you know, Natural Remedy asthma. And the thing is, you have to research it. You have to spend the time.
You read a bunch of different articles and kind of take what you think makes sense. Because sometimes, you'll get like the witch doctor thing that's, oh, hey, send me $50 and I will send you this little thing that is going to cure your asthma for good. You'll never have any trouble again. Which, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually it is. But yeah.
So yeah, just do some research, do some reading. There are tons of books.
Take everything with a grain of salt and kind of figure out what makes the most sense to you, because it really is often just about common sense.
As long as you take everything with a grain of pink Himalayan salt has all the
unrefined
minerals.
Yes. Pink Himalayan salt with all of the minerals intact.
Stuff.
You don't want the Morton salt, which is ironically comes from the town that my parents live in. That's one case when I didn't eat local.
But isn't that interesting that, you know, at some point the whole town's going to fall into the ground because everything's been mined out from underneath. Ironic. So that ties... Oh, go ahead.
Well, and I have one more thing to talk about as far as other ways, way to help prevent disease and health issues is to consume fermented foods in addition to eating a wide variety of fruits and vegetables and finding healthy, fresh, you know, meat if possible, if you eat meat and dairy products. Try to consume fermented foods, particularly in the winter, because they boost your immune system and help you fight off all of the colds and flus that have a tendency to go around, which I think has more to deal with vitamin D issues than it does, you know, more flus and stuff in the air, but that's beside the point. But consuming fermented foods with every meal, that helps your body extract more of the nutrients from your food. So the naturally fermented foods like kimchi, sauerkraut, traditionally fermented pickles, yogurt, if you consume just a little bit of that with every single meal, it's going to help your body absorb more vitamins and minerals from the things that you do eat, because it activates, you know, it helps kind of balance out your intestinal flora, which that's where all of the vitamins and minerals are absorbed. So if you can kind of balance that out and have a really good levels of healthy bacteria, that's going to do wonders. Those also help your body fight off diseases and, you know, like colds, flus, etc. If you can have good healthy gut flora, they're going to be able to overcome the bad bacteria much more readily and easily than if you don't. So that will also, I mean, that's one of the ways that it helps keep you healthier.
And a lot of these things too, a lot of things you just mentioned with kimchi and sauerkraut and yogurt, a lot of these things can be integrated. You sort of have to think outside of the typical meal in order to integrate them. But once you start to eat them with the meals, like we, you know, usually for breakfast we have eggs, sometimes bacon with that. And recently, you know, I mean, over the past year or so, we've been eating a small side of sauerkraut with that. And you think, well, gee, that's
the weird.
Typical, you know, let's have eggs and bacon and sauerkraut. It's not typical, but once you start eating it, it really starts to, it is a good mix.
It becomes, I mean, yeah, sauerkraut pairs perfectly with pork and sausage, so
yeah,
why not? I mean, a sauerkraut sausage omelet is really good. I mean, it might sound kind of weird, but once you have it, it's fantastic. And once you do start eating, and it's not like you need to eat, you know, 2 cups of sauerkraut with your breakfast, you know, like a quarter cup on the side as kind of a condiment is all you need usually of these fermented products.
And just like we had, not chili, but what was that spicy thing we had a couple weeks ago?
Hungarian goulash, which is super healthy. It's got lots of caraway and paprika, and I mean, that's got tons of really great herbs and spices in it, perfect for winter, for helping your body fight off, you know, all kinds of stuff, and for lots of vitamins and stuff.
And it's kind of hot and spicy, and so, you know, one of the times she served it, there was a big dollop of yogurt on the top, and I was like, oh, gee, that's kind of weird, putting yogurt on your goulash, which is, if you don't know what goulash is basically like meat and vegetables in sort of a spicy hot...
It's like a really thick stew, kind of, and like a tomato-based kind of a sauce.
And then put a big dollop of yogurt on top of that, and you're thinking, geez, okay. But actually, it's great. And then I wanted more yogurt because of the spices, it cools down you know, the spiciness of it, but then it also just has a good taste that goes along with the spiciness and the meat and everything else. And so,
and it'll help reduce problems with any kind of indigestion or heartburn that some people might have with some meals like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and sour cream is the same. The sour cream you buy in the store in those plastic tubs, not really what you're looking for as far as probiotics, but if you can find someone locally or if you can buy cultures and make your own sour cream, sour cream is a fantastic probiotic to add to your food. I mean, that's one of the reasons that's added to a lot of traditional, like, Hispanic foods. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was usually the traditional fermented kind, and it just helps digest everything and
not
keeps
the processed, mostly chemical.
It's not the stuff with all the gums and all that weird stuff in it. It's the naturally fermented stuff, a culture and some cream. It's as simple as that.
So you mentioned one of the books of the week. Are there any others?
Right. One of the books of the week is called Healing Spices, and this is a fantastic resource when it comes to a little bit of research as far as the health benefits of adding more herbs and spices. And this book is really great. I have, I don't know, four or five different books on spices and the health benefits, and they have recipes, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the one that I think is the best if you want to dabble in it or read about it. This book is easy to understand. It has, you can read through it like a book, but it's also like a cookbook because there are tons of recipes in it. And it also can be like a reference encyclopedia because it lists all of the books or all of the herbs and spices. It lists them, it talks about them, the history, what people's traditionally used them, what they're good for, how to introduce them in the diet, what other herbs and spices they pair best with. And then there's a recipe with every single herb and spice that's, so you can try it, see if you like it. There's a recipe there that gives you one of the traditional ways that it's used, and I think it's a great book. I would highly recommend, this is a definite, I would recommend it as a buy. I mean, not just because it's really interesting and it'll not only open your mind to the idea of the fact that spices and herbs are just as healthy or more healthful than vegetables, but it also will give you kind of an interest, lots of interesting new herbs and spices to try. I mean, because as Americans, we often eat our very bland kind of food. We have a couple of spices that we use sometimes. If you dabble in a couple ethnic cuisines, you have some others that you try. But I mean, I was reading and I've bought probably 10 different herbs and spices in the last couple months since I got this book that I'd never even heard of before. And I'm pretty adventurous as far as herbs and spices are concerned and have, you know, probably close to 100 different herbs and spices in my spice cabinet. So, I mean, it's fascinating and it's great to try and it's fun for, it'd be a great way to get your kids into it too. You know, pick an herb a week, have your kids read up on it, study the culture that it comes from, give them a little history behind it, and your kids are going to be more willing to try it because it's interesting to them. It's not just that you're putting down this plate of something new in front of them. They know where it comes from. They've talked about it. I mean, it's just a great learning experience. So I would definitely recommend buying this book if you're interested in incorporating more herbs and spices in your diet. And then there are two other books I want to recommend. One is called The Art of Fermentation, which just came out. I just ordered a copy. I don't have it yet. And then Wild Fermentation. These are both about fermented foods. If you want kind of a more in-depth, encyclopedic volume, The Art of Fermentation is the one for you. It's a fat book with all kinds of stuff in it. Wild Fermentation is a small book. It just has tons of recipes and tons of information about fermenting. So if you want to dabble in fermenting and aren't sure if you're going to be wanting to read in depth or try a ton of different stuff, Wild Fermentation, it's only like a $15 book, but it's great. It'll be a great primer on fermenting and give you a lot of different things that you can try, recipes and different fermented foods that you can make and incorporate in your diet. And I also want to mention that in the show notes, I'll have links to three of my blog posts that have recipes for our kimchi, our sauerkraut, and the naturally fermented pickles that we make that we also consume as part of our, that's kind of like our summer fermented food that we eat a lot is pickles.
And so that brings us on to reader questions. We've been getting a lot of feedback in the podcast notes, but also in just regular blog posts. If we see a question that interests us, we throw it into this section of the show. And so we have a few today. One, the first one here is from Josie. It says, will you please share what photo software you like? The daughter? Really? The daughter is taking a photography class, and a tool to tag and save her journey to become a savvy little photographer would be great. And then suggest possibly an ebook on this topic. And a lot of the software that's out there, I would recommend definitely getting a, I don't want to say high end because that makes it sound expensive, but some of them are expensive. I don't even know. We have all Mac computers, and so Susie uses Aperture.
Right. And I used to use iPhoto, which is great if you don't have a ton of pictures because you can tag stuff, you can organize it easily. I mean,
and that comes with the Mac. If you buy a Mac, right. iPhoto comes
on
it for free.
And it has minimal kind of photo editing. You can adjust the white balance, adjust the saturation, you know, pretty much. That was fine for me until I started getting massive amounts of photos. Then iPhoto was just kind of choking on me all the time. And I needed a few more options as far as editing was concerned.
And organization.
So I upgraded to Aperture, which isn't that expensive.
I don't know.
It's pretty cheap now. It's cheaper now than when I first got it.
Is it $100 or somewhere around there? I don't know. Keep talking about it and I'll look that up.
But it's fantastic. I really, really like it for organizational purposes. I find it to be, I like to organize. You can figure out any way that's easiest for you to organize your pictures. I mean, I think it depends on how your mind kind of works and how you personally like to keep things organized. For me, it's easier if I keep things organized by year. So I put all of my pictures for a year in a folder. And then whenever I download my pictures, I tag them with any tag that I can think of, because then I can go into that year and then I can search for, say, if I'm looking for a picture of a tulip, like I was last night, I can go into my, and I know it was a picture that I took this year. So I can go into my 2012 folder, I can type tulip into the search bar, and it pops up every picture that I have tagged with tulip. Now, obviously, this only works really effectively if you are tagging your pictures. If you don't, back in the early days, I didn't tag too much. And then I realized really quickly that I wasted a ton of time looking through all my pictures trying to find a specific one that I knew that I had. And generally, I can remember what year I took it in, so I can go to that year. And in the early years, I wasn't as good as tagging, so it can be difficult for me to find some of the earlier pictures when I'm looking for them. And I have plans someday to go back and go through and tag all of those as well as I do now. But that's how I do it, and that's what works for me. It might be easier for you if you put everything into folders based on topics. So maybe you want all your family vacations in one folder, or maybe you want folders that are, you know, like family vacation to the Catskills and family vacation to the Smoky Mountains, family vacation to Cedar Point. Maybe you want all those in separate folders and you want a big long list. I mean, that's fine too, whatever. Just finding a system that works for you and being
consistent
about organizing your pictures and tagging them, even if you just throw them all in one big thing. As long as you're tagging them, you're going to be able to search and find what you need. And if you can find a photo software that will let you tag stuff, that's probably your most important thing as far as being able to find your pictures and the usability of that.
You actually use the date feature a lot to find out when you did things.
Right.
So, you know, when was it that we planted that, or when was it that we harvested that? And the blog is good for that, but also...
Right, but often I'll go into my photo software and I'll be like, oh, when did I harvest my potatoes last year? So I'll go into my 2011 folder, I'll type in potatoes, and then I can look through and find pictures of, because I try to take pictures. That's kind of how I journal. I try to take pictures of all the different things when I do it. So I know, okay, on September 1st, I harvested all of the potatoes over in my mom's potager. On October 1st, I harvested all of the ones in my own garden, you know, back in Malvern. So then I use the dates all the time too for that, since I use my photos often as kind of a journal, as a garden journal. So, and it tells me the date and the time. So,
and if you don't have a Mac, and I looked it up, Aperture is $79.99. And if you don't have a Mac, then Adobe Lightroom is sort of the competitor slash comparable version. And that's also available on Mac and PC. But it does a lot of the same things. And there are, I mean, if you ask some of my photography friends, there are hours of debate included in which one's better. But whatever. Susie chose Aperture, and that's what she likes, and that's what she's been using. And but Adobe Lightroom is also a good one. So, and then you know, uploading those. Just a tip for your daughter Josie: have her upload photos to Flickr, because that's actually how Susie has been discovered by a lot of magazines and other things. And you get a lot of good feedback on there about photos too. So.
Right.
So moving on to the next question then, and how did we debate this?
Kiskin, I'm going to say.
Kiskin?
As far as name pronunciation.
I'm terrible with name pronunciation. I'm terrible with remembering people's names. I can remember faces. I can remember names, but I can never remember them together. At any rate, Kiskin asks, as to weeds in the garden, my true enemy is ground elder. It's virtually impossible to get rid of. Any ideas? Also known as bishop weed, goat weed, and gout weed. And
then that was my addition.
Oh, that was yours. Yeah. And then mountain in the mountain. Snow in the mountain
is kind
also
of the cultivated, domesticated version of of the ground elder, which is how we probably know it here in the United States.
Okay. So this is kind of a general question. I mean, from what you read, this weed is extremely invasive and extremely hard to get rid of.
I think a lot of weeds are. It's like the Canadian thistle. And
and again, they are not weeds. They are opportunistic species.
And they're a lot of them are herbs that were brought over here by the pilgrims and other travelers because they were important in their medicinal in their medicine cabinet, I guess you would say.
Yeah. But we have Benadryl.
Yeah. So anyways, as with most weeds, I would recommend, you have to be consistent about pulling it. So I would recommend in the first year, dig up the area where you're having trouble, pull out all the plants, try to get out as many of the roots and the rhizomes as you can, because most of these species have deep roots, have lots of roots, and any little piece of root that is left is going to sprout. But if you can get out a large portion of it, then throughout that first year, just be really religious and consistent about pulling up, you know, every week, go out there and pull up any little bits of the weed that you see coming up. And eventually you're going to exhaust the energy of the roots that are there, but you have to be consistent, because if the plants get big, they're going to absorb sunlight, they're going to absorb nutrients, and then, you know, you're never going to win. Being consistent for at least a year, and then the second year, you're probably going to notice that there's the population is starting to wane, and then you can do that for another year. And probably after about 3 years, you'll pretty much have it eradicated. You'll probably have to make sure you pull up a plant here or there after that. But I also want to note that this weed has another name called goat weed, probably because the goats love it. And I've been reading a lot about using goats as managers for invasive and pestiferous species, which they're fantastic at that, about that, because they can eat pretty much anything. They can even eat a lot of poisonous things that other animals can't eat because of the enzymes and stuff that they have in their digestive system. You know, they can eat poison hemlock and it doesn't bother them, or so I've read. And I'll put a couple of links in the show notes. I found one really great article that I'm working through right now about using goats. And maybe you can't have a goat or don't want to have a goat, even if you can find someone that has one that you can have them come over and graze it there and try to eat up some of this. That would be a great way to try to deal with it as well. But yeah, pulling for a year or two is the best way to deal with noxious weeds. And if you can find a chicken or some sort of animal that'll eat it and do it for you, that's the easiest way, because you just kind of fence it in there and let them deal with it.
And if you wanted to, could you, let's say you have an infestation and there's only a couple of other plants that are surviving because of this opportunistic species that has taken over, say, you know, a flower bed or a part of your yard or something like that. Could you go with kind of a I hate to use this word because it sounds like we're using pesticides or herbicides, but kind of a scorched earth approach where you could put down a few layers of cardboard, put down a few layers of, you know, mulch and just kind of let it sit for a year. Would that kill it
as
well?
You could. You'd have to make sure you pull all the weeds first and dig up as many roots as you can. And you'd have to make sure you mulch in an area, especially in a species that's kind of like a ground cover, one that creeps under the ground and sends off roots. You'd have to mulch pretty kind of far outside of its boundaries and keep a close eye and make sure it's not sending sprouts and weeds out from under your mulch. But I mean, that's a good way to do it. But you want to dig it up and pull out as much of it as you can first. And probably burning it is a great option, because any of these kind of ivy kind of weeds, if you pull it up and throw it in your compost pile, you're going to end up spreading it all over your garden, as long as it's not an invasive or like a, you never want to burn like a poison ivy or some sort of a poison plant, because that kind of aerosolizes the things. But if it's something that's not going to put anything weird into the air, then, you know, burn it or throw it on cardboard, throw it on a piece of cardboard and let it desiccate in the sun and then burn it after that. Yeah,
plus
that's your
burning
best
it
option.
Makes it feel good, you know.
It can be,
make
yeah.
Sure it's like revenge, sweet
that's
revenge
right.
To set it on fire
that's
and
right.
Watch it burn.
And do some research, because I read up on this ground elder, and it's actually a really important, it was viewed as a really important pot herb back in the day. It was used medicinally in the spring when it's young and tender. It can be cooked and used like spinach and other stuff, nettles, that kind of a stuff. So, hey, if you can't beat them, join them and start eating them. We did that with the garlic mustard back at our old place. We started eating it, and I noticed once we started eating it regularly, the population was kept under control like you wouldn't believe, because you're constantly out there stripping off the young tender leaves. So try eating it. There are all kinds of medicinal uses for arthritis, and there's a reason it's called gout weed, because it's good for gout. So read up on it. Use it medicinally, eat it if you can, and look into alternative methods. I mean, I think that it's interesting how a lot of other countries use goats for this kind of thing, and they've kind of fallen out of favor in our, you know, modern industrialized world where we have pesticides and herbicides that yeah. We can spray. But if you can find a goat or some sort of an animal that's going to be able to eat it, it's going to not only deal with the problem, but it's going to put down some manure to improve the soil, which often these kinds of weeds are thrive in subpar soil and in areas where the soil has been disturbed and hasn't been replanted with a beneficial species or another, like, better species. So, I mean, they're opportunistic. You scratch up the soil and then they're just going to flourish there because often because of neglect. So if you scratch up an area, or if you get your sewer line put back in, plant something there as soon as possible. Don't let the weeds take over before planting something, because they're going to sprout and grow faster than anything else, and then you're in for an uphill battle if you don't jump on it right away. So and then, you know, the animals will help with that. They can scratch that up, put down manure, improve the soil, make it easier for better species of plants to grow, and kind of give you a leg up, so to speak.
And of course, you know, in my conspiracy theory ways, are weeds really weeds, or are they just weeds so that the weed companies can sell you herbicides?
They're just plants that are growing in the wrong place.
Yeah. So
often, I mean, some of them... Yeah, a lot of things we classify as weeds are actually herbs.
Yeah.
Hence the mixed herbal lawn that we talked about that was so popular.
Yeah, and a lot of people have said that they're going to use that that term when their neighbors say, hey, what's going on with your lawn? And
why do you have weeds in your lawn?
When the HOA comes up to you and says, hey, you know, you really need to take care of the weeds in your lawn. Well, it's a
mixed herbal lawn.
Mixed
creating
herbal
a,
lawn.
I'm trying to save
I'm
the bees.
I'm naturalizing. Yes, I'm trying to save the bees.
Produce pollen for the bees and pollinators.
That's right. So that's the show for this week. That's episode 5, The Dark Side. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to help us out, give us an iTunes review. Head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating if you think we're worthy. And just write a little review there. That helps out when people are searching for a gardening podcast and they read good reviews. You can also help by going to cultivatesimple.com/support. That'll take you to our support page, and using that Amazon link that we keep harping on and nobody's using, I don't think. The last month, our Amazon revenue went up by $3. So, yeah.
It's better than going down, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. So if you're buying anything off Amazon, just use that affiliate link. And also be sure to check out Eat Outside the Bag. And many of the recipes that we're posting this week are actually on that website, eatoutsidethebag.com, which is Susie's other blog, one of her many other places she writes. And recipes and different things over there for simple foods and simple meals that you can make. And, you know, try using some of these herbs this week. And also, speaking of herbs, and another way to support the blog, if you go to cultivatesimple.com and there's the /support, there's the Mountain Rose Herbs link.
I have like an affiliate account with them, so if you click through my blog, then I get a certain percentage of whatever you order from them.
That's where
I get all of my herbs and spices. They have a great selection. I mean, they pretty much have everything. There are very few things that I have not been able to buy through them, and most of them are organic, which is, I think, important when you're going for herbs, because they're more
nutrient dense.
Yeah, if they're organic. A lot of them, some of them are wild crafted. Some of them they grow themselves. You can head on over to their blog too. They have lots of great information and pictures over there about herbs and spices. But yeah, I really appreciate what they do and the quality products that they have. And if you look in my spice pantry, I think just about every single herb or spice that I have comes with the Mountain Rose Herbs label, because I'm very impressed with the company. I love, you know, what they do and what they stand for, and so I support them with my money.
And just another quick tip is that when you get the Mountain Rose Herbs, most of them come in plastic bags, and so Susie stores them in glass jars, and the labels on the plastic bags
peel off
and can be put onto the glass jars. So then you have all the information on the label right there in the glass jar. And then
I love to use the jars that the Tropical Traditions coconut oil comes in. They're perfect because they have like the straight flat side. So most of my herbs and spices are stored in jars that used to contain coconut oil. And it's like a small celebration when I use up a jar of coconut oil, because then I know I have a new herb jar.
And we need some new ones because I bought a bunch of new herbs.
So I have a bunch of herbs that are still sitting in the plastic bags. So we need to start eating up lots of coconut oil so I can get some herb jars.
And finally, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to leave those on the post for this episode, for episode number 5, The Dark Side. Or you can contact us at show@cultivatesimple.com. And this week, we've got an action-packed week. We're going to be doing a ton of stuff. And trying to get everything ready. The weather is turning cold around here, and we're going to be in the mid-40s during the day and the mid-30s at night. And so we're going to be running around like crazy trying to get things done. Just
putting all of our hoops in the garden and putting up all the floating row covers to protect all of the little spinach seedlings, and planting garlic, mulching,
it's
all that
be a
kind
busy
of good
week.
Stuff. Yeah.
Plus our, you know, day jobs.
That's right. Plus my 5-day jobs. and writing all these ebooks.
Yeah, that's right. You never knew that the simple life could be so complicated.
That's right.
But, you know, everything that we do this week, we're just going to try to cultivate simple.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend. I'd rather do some thinking now. But somehow it all depends. If I could fly away from me, come and face the longing. Whoa, on my knees. I'd rather see my hometown. I'd rather hold my wife. I'd rather never question. That's the story of my life. I'd rather not be crying. I'd rather just be whole. I'd rather brave the cleansing fire. I'd rather feed my soul. If I could fly. Open to suggestions. I'm crying out to you. I'm ready to be finished here. I'm ready for this season to be if I could fly.